Optimist Club has been meeting daily, and every morning at breakfast tries to cheer me up, and they've been unsuccessful. I'm Michael Pellett, and I am a Lutheran pastor in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, at King of Glory Lutheran Church, and I also teach in the philosophy department at the University of Saskatchewan at the St. Thomas More, which is the Roman Catholic college on the campus. This week, what we have been doing in terms of looking at Holden's summer theme, the many-colored grace of God, is looking at five parables under the umbrella title of the unforgiven, because what happens in each of these parables, although of course they are parables about grace and want to say something about grace as the way God does things somewhere, it's the very perplexing, frustrating, however you want to characterize that, notion that in these parables, at the end of the parable, someone, something ends up unforgiven. And how can that be? And how can that notion of unforgiveness that's going on in these parables actually give us some insights into grace and our understanding of grace and how we live in grace, forgiveness, the love of God? And so that's what we have been trying to look at, and each day from a little different angle with a different parable. And today we're going to look at the parable of the great banquet, and primarily look at it in terms of the way Matthew tells us this parable. As you can see here, it's in Matthew, Luke, and Thomas. And as introduction, we'll look at all three of them briefly. But I want to look at Matthew in particular because, of course, it is the most difficult and the most despondent. So we'll do that. So to start out, please. Matthew 22, verses 1 to 14. And again, I'll give you the way I translate this parable, because this is the parable we'll be spending most of our time with. Beginning at verse 1. And responding, Jesus again spoke in parables to them, saying, "The kingdom of the heavens is similar to a person, a king, who made a wedding banquet for his son. And he sent his servants to summon those who had been invited into the wedding banquet, and they were not wishing to come. Again, he sent other servants, saying, 'Look, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fatted calves have been slaughtered, and all things are ready. Come for the wedding feast.' But they, who could care less, went off, one to his own farm, another to his business of trade. And the rest, overpowering his servants, humiliated and killed them. And the king was enraged, and sending his troops, destroyed those murderers and burned their city. Then he says to his servants, 'Indeed, the wedding feast is ready, but the ones who had been invited were not worthy to come. Therefore, move out upon the avenues, and as many as you might find, invite into the wedding banquet.' And going out into the streets, the slaves gathered together all whom they found, both bad and good. And the wedding banquet hall was filled with guests. But when the king entered to observe the guests, he noticed there was a man who was not dressed in wedding attire. And he says to him, 'Friend, How did you get in here without having the proper wedding attire? And he was speechless. Then the king said to the table servers, tie him up hand and foot and throw him out into the outer darkness. There will be wailing and grinding of teeth. For many are called, but few chosen. All right. Before we say anything, please turn to Luke 14, verses 12 to 24. And again, I'll read it this time. I'm just going to read it from the NRSV. Because my purpose in having us look at Luke 14 and the parable there is, as you hear it and follow along, try to note what is different between the way Luke tells this parable and the way Matthew tells this parable. So Luke 14, 12 to 24. He said also to the one who had invited him, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, in case they may invite you in return and you would be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. One of the dinner guests, on hearing this, said to him, blessed is anyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God. Then Jesus said to him, someone gave a great dinner and invited many. At the time for the dinner, he sent his slave to say to those who had been invited, come, for everything is ready now. But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said to him, I have bought a piece of land, and I must go out and see it. Please accept my regrets. Another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I am going to try them out. Please accept my regrets. Another said, I have just been married, and therefore I cannot come. So the slave returned and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and said to his slave, go out at once into the streets and lanes of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. And the slave said, sir, what you ordered has been done, and there is still room. Then the master said to the slave, go out into the roads and lanes and compel people to come in, so that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of those who were invited will taste my dinner. And one more. This is tough. This is from the Gospel of Thomas. And again, similar parable. Please listen, because we're going to try to see similarities and differences. As Thomas tells this parable, Jesus said, a man had received visitors, and when he had prepared dinner, he sent his servant to invite the guests. He went to the first one and said to him, my master invites you. He said, I have claims against some merchants. They are coming to me this evening. I must go and give them my orders. I ask to be excused from the dinner. He went to another and said to him, my master has invited you. He said to him, I have just bought a house and am required for the day. I shall not have any spare time. He went to another and said to him, my master invites you. He said to him, my friend is going to get married and I am to prepare the banquet. I shall not be able to come. He went to another and said to him, my master invites you. He said to him, I have just bought a farm. And I am on my way to collect the rent. I shall not be able to come. I ask to be excused. The servant returned to his master and said, Those whom you invited to dinner have asked to be excused. The master said to his servant, go out to the streets and bring back those whom you happen to meet, so they may dine. Businessmen and merchants will not enter the places of my Father. Yeah. All right. Just looking at Matthew, Luke, and Thomas, what do you see as the differences? What about Matthew? What's distinctive to Matthew? What?
In Matthew, they killed the invitees.
Okay, in Matthew, some of the invitees were killed.
Also in Matthew, they were concerned about their appearance, how they dressed.
Okay, we've got that whole wedding attire issue.
Matthew, the host is a king. The others, it's a father or a...
It's a king, and it's also a wedding banquet. Right? The others, it's just big deal banquet.
It's for his son.
For his son.
In Matthew, it's the same people were invited twice.
Yeah, that's right. We've got a double invitation. Double invitation to the same ones. Okay.
And in Matthew, they don't give reasons. They make fun, actually, of the invitation, and they don't give reasons why they can't come.
Right.
And the others, they give reasons.
Right. Matthew kind of has a no excuses thing. It's the notion, first time, it's that sense they don't wish to come, and the second time, ameletes, it means they could care less. Right. The sense of they...
Insulting, huh?
You mean they couldn't care less.
Huh?
They couldn't care less.
Well, they didn't. Anything else about what you see there is distinctive for Matthew?
They humiliated the servant.
Yeah.
What's it? Humiliated the servant.
Killed him.
Something... That sense of humiliated and killed and all of that, but again, it's a distinctive action. And again, in the other two parables, the servants aren't humiliated. Okay, what about Luke? What do you see there as distinctive?
Special instructions don't invite any friends.
Okay, so you've got the special instruction, the way it ends, those who were initially invited, right, will not taste my dinner. What else for Luke?
Isn't that where he says many are invited, but few will be accepted?
No, that's Matthew.
Matthew, okay.
They compel them to come in, didn't they?
Yeah. They compel. The other thing in Luke is that there is also a double invitation. But note, the difference is in Matthew, the double invitation is to the same ones, to the ones who didn't show. In Luke, it's we went out there, go get all of those folks. And the banquet hall wasn't filled, so in Luke, go out, we need more. Right. Ring the bell twice. Maybe they'll come the second, right? Compel them in.
What are the differences? It's in Luke, Jesus says, don't invite your friends because they're obligated to invite you back again.
Right, there's that whole beginning stuff there about a shorthand, I'll call it social honor. Right? You know, if I invite you to my party, then of course you're going to feel under obligation that sometime when you throw a party, you have to invite me back. Because even if you don't like me, you have to do that because to not do so would be an embarrassment and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, the I scratch your back, you scratch mine social thing. Yes.
Luke invites a social outcast.
He
invites a social outcast.
He's got the outcasts.
The cripple, the poor, the blind, the lame.
Right. And he keeps emphasizing that, right? They're there somewhat, obviously, in Matthew as well, but of course, Luke, which has sometimes been labeled the gospel for the poor, really emphasizes that to make sure that these are the folks we're after. Anything else?
Well, we've already put it under Matthew, but they do give reasons for declining.
Yeah, there's...
Not always the greatest reasons, but reasons.
Well, we'll look at that very briefly in terms of they're not reasons at all. They're just lies.
There's no exclusion because of not being properly dressed.
Right, so I mean the whole wedding garment thing and the whole wedding motif, right? Not there. All right, let's take a quick look at Thomas. What do you see distinctive in Thomas?
He doesn't like businessmen and merchants.
Yeah, I know.
He has an extensive listing of excuses.
Yes.
They also
I want just the excuses thing for a second. What's distinctive about the excuses in Thomas over against the others?
They're all business.
They're all business, and also in Thomas, it breaks on the usual patterns of three. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thomas has four excuses. And of course, when you have four excuses, and again, they're all back to the business and the merchant. I mean, three is the normal pattern. You know, but if you go one more time, it means we really don't like business. Four times.
No doubts about that.
No doubts about that.
Plus, he says it at the end.
Plus, he says it, right? For there, the little moral of the story is businessmen and merchants, no place for you. Anything else that you note about Thomas? Okay, good. That's the key issues I want to get at. One more notion of the banquet, and of course, banquet is again as we yesterday vineyards were key metaphors. Banquet is a key metaphor here, and I know you'll remember absolutely everything we've said about Luke and Thomas, so we can grace that. And I'd like you to look at Isaiah chapter 25, verses 6 to 10. And here, if someone would read that for me, please. Isaiah chapter 25, 6 to 10. Again, one of the most eloquent expressions of a banquet, and of course this is what will happen when God throws a banquet.
And in this mountain shall the Lord of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wines on the lees well refined. And he will destroy in this mountain the face of the covering cast over all people, and the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death in victory, and the Lord God will wipe away tears
from off all faces, and the rebuke of his people shall he take away from off all the earth, for the Lord hath spoken it. And it shall be said on that day, lo, this is our God. We have awaited for him, and he will save us. This is the Lord. We have waited for him. We will be glad and rejoice in his salvation. For in this mountain shall the hand of the Lord rest, and Moab shall be trodden down under him, even as straw is trodden down for the dunghill.
Yes, thank you. Now, of course, when this lesson is read for us, it's in our lectionary during the church year. We always hear it up until verse 10a. Right? We've got the great feast. And we don't read, excuse the crassness there, to say, while we're all feasting away, our enemies are going to eat shit. Because, right, the whole understanding here is that Israel is anticipating the day of deliverance, the day of God, when the Messiah comes and there is that great banquet of salvation and deliverance for Jerusalem and so on and so forth. Right? What it means is it's going to be a great banquet for us, and we're going to be eating the whole... I mean, it's going to be a terrific Cafe Holden, and there's going to be meat, right? And all that stuff. And as well, the entertainment for the evening is we get to see our enemies tortured and punished and suffer. What could be better than that? My just sitting back and watching all of you suffer. Man, that's what I call fun. Or again, from the Matins today, Bartlett's quotations, right? One that I'm sure is in there somewhere. Revenge is sweet. And there you have, right? And so we've got a little bit of that in all of these parables of the great banquet. So that again, right, this is where it starts getting a bit troubling if it's about grace to say, well, okay, well, where's the grace? Well, initially we're going to think, well, that's an easy question. The grace is, of course, those who were invited did not attend. Now, the grace is go out to the highways and the byways, right? Invite the outcasts. Invite all those others. And you go, yeah, a gracious God. But there's also, right, in those parables, that sense of revenge. And we see that in spades in Matthew, because after all, for some of them who did not come to the banquet and were attacked the king's slaves or messengers and humiliated and killed them, they in turn were killed. And Luke, right, none of those first invited will taste my dinner. And of course, in Thomas as well, businessmen and merchants need not apply. So there's always that sense there of somehow we're not involved.
And the one that doesn't have the right clothes, that's really...
Well, right, see, that's Matthew, and that's the trouble, because on the one hand, this guy is part of the poor, the outcast, and all of that, and gets invited in, and yet, because he's not wearing the proper wedding garment, the proper attire, he gets kicked out. And I think it was in the little blurb there on the kiosk, my question is, when you invite the homeless and street people to a banquet, How can you throw them out for not wearing tuxedos and evening gowns? Right? That doesn't sound very gracious. So, but that's at the end of the parable, so we won't worry about that until maybe 10 to 10. There are other things here in terms of Matthew's story and what we need to think of and what's going on in all of these notions here and even in Isaiah. It's the sense of honor, right? One's honor, position, status, reputation in society is tremendously important. And so what's happening in this parable, and I'll stick with Matthew here, what happens to this king who has this banquet, all those folks who say, no, I'm sorry, I won't attend, I mean, this is an insult, a slap in the face, a dishonoring of the king. And so part of the parable here, as with all the others, is how will this person who has been just basically kicked off the social register and will never show up in talk of the town at the New Yorker or anything, how does he regain his status and his honor? And we'll see there again. That's going to happen in a funny way. One other comment, kind of a side comment, but you know, in our context, I think important to say, the notion of the banquet is a symbol, metaphor, messianic banquet. It's end of the world talk. How does the world end? According to Jewish, and in this case Christian understanding, the world does not end with a bang or a whimper or the rapture. Sorry, Harold Kapp. If you are right on October 21st, 2011, there will not be a rapture, but there will be a cosmic party. Because that's the understanding of the end of the world. The final judgment, if you will, is going to be celebration. And of course, we should all know that because within a liturgical tradition, celebrating the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist, as we say, a foretaste of the feast to come, right? We're anticipating that great cosmic end of the world party already. So we celebrate. And that's here too. And so we've got this juxtaposition of celebration and dishonoring, right? Someone who has been snubbed, who's been dishonored, what are we going to do about that? Okay. To work our way through. Again, in terms of just a little chart here to see, I've called this is the movement that happens in the parable. There's the double invitation, there's a triple response, there's the king's response the first time there, then there's the new invitation, and of course then the person who is ejected from the banquet for not being properly attired. And we'll take a little look at all of those and see what kind of trouble we can get ourselves into. First of all, in Matthew, right, the double invitation. And part of what we need to understand here again is in the culture and context, especially with regard to those of higher status, any party or banquet has a double invitation. And so you see, this is what makes the slap in the face even worse. So that, because you might look at it otherwise to say, well, boy, wasn't this king really stupid? Here he goes, slaughters his oxen, his fatted calves, gets everything ready, and then goes out and invites them? That's kind of dumb. But no, because we've got the way things work in that, right? Let's say the initial invitation would have gone out 3 months earlier. Just like now, when you receive a wedding invitation or something like that, you're going to get that invitation weeks, maybe even months in advance to say, you know, so-and-so and so-and-so are going to get married. So, you know, if you will, you put that on your calendar. Now, of course, what happens here is often these banquets and stuff go for days and everything, and there's then the preparation, and so then once everything is ready, you send out your messengers with that invitation, right, that simply says, come. And again, in terms of that, there's a standard form for this second invitation. You know, whoever, it would read something like this. It would be, Big Delius invites you to dine at the banquet of my son's marriage in the great wedding hall tomorrow, that is the 15th from the ninth hour. So you all know and you say, and so you see, right, what makes this insult here is apparently these folks had received the initial invitation and it said yes. Or at least they did not say no. Right? They did not say, oh, I'm sorry, I can't attend that day because you see back that I'll be checking out my farm or checking out my oxen or I'm getting married. So that would have been the appropriate time to say, no, I cannot attend. But there's assumed that this is a yes, and so now they get the little announcement, come, it's all ready, and they say, no can do. Right. You can see the king is ticked off. Right. As indeed we might be. Right? This is not good.
In this case, the king prepared beforehand and did know or had an idea of who was coming, as opposed to killing a fatted calf and then inviting people.
Yes, right. That's right. It, because the initial invitation went out, those people said yes, so he basically said, well, you know, okay, I've got 1,000 guests coming, and I've made all the prep for 1,000 guests, and now I go out there, and they've all said no. Right? I mean, again, we work in threes for that sense of completeness, but the understanding here, one thing that Matthew, Luke, Thomas all have in common is that all who were initially invited all said no. Right. So again, right, it's the hyperbole of the parable. It really, you can see this is going to, I mean, think about that. You're planning for your 50th wedding anniversary, and you've sent the invitations out 3 months in advance, inviting all your friends, neighbors, family, that they all said yes, and the day of your anniversary, no one shows. How do you feel about that? Huh? Yeah. Angry, dejected, right? Just another day of disappointment and despair. And it's worse, right? Because by not showing that, it is an insult. You are humiliated. Right? And so, the sense of that is the humiliation. I mean, it almost appears to be a conspiracy. Why would everybody say no? And again, in terms of the way the story is constructed, literarily this would be called a violation of triadic expectation. And what that means is that, again, right, everything comes in threes, but usually one and two are the same, and then the third is a surprising kind of reversal. Think about the parable of the Good Samaritan. There's the victim on the side of the road, priest comes, walks by, Levite comes, walks by, Samaritan comes, stops, right? So as you're giving this parable, you would say, again, the kind of thing, invite the first person, you know, Big Delius says, come. No. Second person, Big Delius says, come. No. Third person, Big Delius says, come. Okay, right? That's what should happen. That's what the hearers are anticipating. And the third one also says, no. In fact, in Matthew, right, it's not just saying no, it's I'm going to humiliate that messenger and kill him. Which is a pretty forceful way of saying no. Right? You receive the invitation and you kill the postman. Okay, so again, we get this sense here of just how much of a dishonor it is. What do you make of the king sending out the invitation to the same ones twice?
Giving him a second chance.
Asking for a double slap in the face.
He might be acting, well, he does get a double slap in the face. Yeah. What else?
He offers grace.
Second chance. Perhaps.
Could be a threat, too.
Could be a threat.
Because he's the king after all.
Yeah.
He's a king after all.
Well, I give them the benefit of doubt.
Could be giving them the benefit of the doubt.
I was just reading a little bit before this, and he was talking to the chief priests and Pharisees, who really he was getting mad, but the multitude, they were afraid of the multitude.
Yeah, so I mean, part of these parables...
Twists the sword, or something, you know.
Yeah, it's addressed. I mean, the audience there is not just simply the disciples or the crowds, but religious leaders are also around, and they're kind of, you know, they kind of catch some of that and say, hey, he's talking about us, and we don't like it. I think the other thing, what you've said here for the double invitation, that applies... And I think as well, the double invitation here indicates the king's desperation and urgency. Right? One of the things that link this parable with the parable of the laborers in the vineyard. Remember, there the vineyard owner goes out 6, 9, noon, 3, and 5. Well, why do you have to do that? The urgency, right? I got to get those grapes picked. Or whatever. Saying here the urgency in the sense that, you know, I've got all this stuff on the table. You know, somebody's got to eat it. Because, you know, I don't want leftovers for the next 3.5 years, right? So, you know, it's more than just a week in review here. So I need urgency. I need urgency. I got to get people. And again, for that sense of honor, right, we have to do those things. Just an aside, again, in terms of Luke's gospel and the others with regard to the excuses, just to say very briefly, all those excuses are lies. Why? Because again, if you read the rabbis and the law, it is such that you would have, if you buy land, you have to go out there and and look it over ahead of time and put that all in a document before you make the final purchase. Same with regard to oxen and animals, and of course, with regard to marriage, all of that stuff would have been worked out in advance too. So in other words, the excuses are lies, and the original hearer would always know it. Right. So again, it's that sense of dishonor. We know this king is being dishonored by these people because their excuses are really not legitimate excuses at all. They are lies. With regard to that, that's there in other traditions as well. Interesting quote. This is from the Sufi mystic Al-Ghazali, who comes much later. But again, within the Islamic tradition, there are similar stories and parables like this. And here's his comment on the end of one. He says here, quote unquote, "Listen, my friend, if you do not want to be with God, it is not because you are too busy, but because you do not like God, do not want God, and you had better face the fact." You know. So there you go, all those folks who give the I'm just so busy I don't have time for church. All right, Al-Ghazali says, well, you know, face the fact. You're just rejecting God, right? Let's be clear about that. Don't lie. That's what's going on here. The whole thing about the businessmen and merchants, I think here what it's trying to say is, don't let your occupation become your preoccupation. Because if you are so preoccupied with your business, your career, your whatever, God's gone. God's out of your life. That's the problem.
Remember Thomas's background that he should be so opposed to business and merchants. What was his background?
Well, again, here the Gospel of Thomas is what's understood as a Gnostic Gospel, yeah, which is a particular sect that develops not only in Christianity but Judaism and elsewhere, and it's very dualistic. In the sense that it makes a division between the spiritual and everything else in the world. Let's call that the material for shorthand. And basically what the Gospel of Thomas wants to always communicate is that one's whole life should be directed toward the spiritual, and that way of doing things and material is simply out of the question. Right? That it finally can become so dualistic that you say spiritual is good, material is evil. And so that's again part of what we're getting here, Tom, that the Gospel of Thomas would be saying, you know, don't be preoccupied at all with things of the world. You should be totally, completely, fully devoted to the spiritual life. And so in that sense, it's an ascetic kind of lifestyle and advocacy that's there. Okay, let's get back to Matthew here. We've got the double invitation, all of that, and of course, there is the rejection. And so the host has been dishonored, rejected, shamed. And therefore, because the host has been dishonored, what he has to do is try to regain his honor. And so, therefore, that's the next move, right? The new invitation. And so, therefore, right, the kind of thing there, well, there's two things. I mean, there's the first way. verse 7, right, that very troubling verse. The king's enraged, sends out troops, destroys those murderers, destroys that city. Again, the sense there, certainly that's one way you can respond and try to get your honor back, right? That notion of revenge, and we've talked about that a little bit. But then, and the more significant and important thing, the new invitation, and again, the language is like a military command, and that's why I translated it that way too. Therefore, move out and invite all those folks from the highways and the byways, if you will, to this banquet. All right. Now, think hard. How would inviting the people that are noted there restore this king's honor?
It's very public.
Public?
By dressing properly, you want to appreciate the invitation. Dressing appropriately.
Yeah. Well, no, we don't want to. No dressing yet.
Okay.
We're just out to the highways and the byways. We can't. The dressing comes later as a surprise, and it's going to upset us again. But how does going to the highways and byways restore his honor?
Because it dishonors those who he invited in the first place. So they see all these people who they would see as outcasts and whatnot being invited by the king. And so by dishonoring them, it honors the, I don't know.
Yeah.
No,
that's good. Here's my probably way too cutesy way of saying it, right? Instead of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, this is a snub for a snub.
Well, they're all dead, though.
Huh?
They were all killed. So.
Well, but see there again, don't, this is a parable, you cannot take Matthew literally. Because if you do, you have terrible problems. Because after all, if you burn the city, how can you hold a banquet in the city? And secondly, right, if the feast was prepared and ready, and then you go out and fight a war, things are probably kind of cold by then, aren't they? And they don't have the microwave to rewarm them. So, right, there's all sorts of signals in the story. If you take this literalistically, you are lost. Right? It's all the metaphor. It's all hyperbole to get us to think about this. So that, right, the king has been snubbed, and so therefore this invitation to all of these unworthies who are not, is the way to snub all of those who snub the king. So that in that sense, right, now you have to ask yourself, well, then is this invitation really talking about grace, or is it talking about revenge? Or let's put these two together. Is grace really a snub? So to say God is gracious to us is just another way of saying God snubs us. Anybody want to comment on that? People upstairs, you're the wise ones up there. What do you think? Grace is a snub?
Why do I need grace? I've got my own integrity.
Right? Maybe we have to readjust the hymn a little bit. Amazing grace. How sour the sound that snubbed a wretch like me.
Well, you know, there's a whole theme in Scripture of the people of Israel being the first, and when they won't come to the banquet, then. So, I mean, we really are the result of a snub. I mean, in the missionary work, in the whole extension of the grace of the gospel to us, who are not of Jewish descent.
Yeah, boy, what What kind of proclamation is that to say, you know? I have been baptized. I've been snubbed by God. I'm part of God's snubbing. Makes you feel good, huh?
Welcome to the club.
Isn't it the other way that God's invited everyone and those that haven't responded are odd personnel?
Yes, indeed. The parable is saying that inviting those seemingly unworthy is the way of snubbing those who were first invited. But what it also means, right, when we push that a little further, it means that those who are invited are all part of this king's way, dare we say it, God's way of snubbing.
So then, if we're going along those veins, if the Israelis had truly accepted them, we'd have been out. We'd have never been invited.
Let's not turn this into kind of any anti-Jewish or anything like that, because you see here again the sense of the snubbing is, right, if you will, grace snubs our self-righteousness, exactly as you said, right? That's what's going on here in terms of the recognition that if we say a gracious God has come into my life, that's also admitting that in many respects we've been snubbed by our self-righteousness, who we think we are, any sense of our own status, honor, worthiness. Grace snubs it.
Yeah, there's the theme, like a couple of days ago, of equality, because when the servants are sent out to gather, it's the good and the bad alike.
Right. Again, it's that, and they're a sign of the gracious invitation. Come one, come all, right? And we know already, it's like in Matthew, the parable of the wheat and the weeds, right? And the sense, don't pull out the weeds while the wheat is still growing, because that'll hurt the wheat too. So, you know, wheat and weeds, good and bad, going to grow together. At this party, good and bad, they're all going to be there.
So I have a scripture I've typed out, 1 Corinthians 1:27. I don't know if it fits here or not. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's Paul's way of talking about how grace snubs. Yeah. And he goes on there, you know, further in 1 Corinthians 1 to kind of say to that community, well, you know, look at who you were, right? I mean, not many of you were wise, not many of you were rich and all that. In other words, most of you were pretty low on the social chain. And, right, God chose what was foolish, what was not honored, and so on and so forth, and all of that. All right, one more move here. And again, as if this notion of grace is a snub is not enough, the other thing that happens here is to say, is this going to restore this king's honor? The thing is, really, no. Because to examine that, I'll just tell you what I have here, right? By going out and inviting all those homeless and street people and whatnot, right? The king willingly loses his place of honor. Right? This is not a parable of upward mobility. It's a parable of downward graciousness. In other words, what happens is the host loses, the king loses his upper class status and joins his reputation to those who are poor, unclean, outcasts, living in the streets. The king does not raise the poor up. But the king puts himself down to join them.
So the king meets them where they are at.
He meets them where they're at, right? By inviting these people in, he links his honor, reputation, status with them. Becomes one of them. In that sense, this movement here of the new invitation and who he invites is just like the Christ hymn in Philippians 2. Right, this is another way of talking about incarnation. How does God become one of us? By inviting us to his party. Because if we're invited to God's party, it certainly doesn't boost his status. Nobody's going around saying, "Wow, God, you're great! Look at all those schmucks you invited." In fact, God comes to us, incarnates, right? Takes the form of a servant, Philippians 2. That is, right, the real heart and center of what graciousness is about in this parable. This king links his honor and his status to all of those in the streets, the poor, the outcast.
Wow. It's 4 minutes to ten. I'm still wondering.
Get out!
So we still got to remember that the guy who didn't have the robe on means that everybody else did.
I know.
So even though they were the downcast, they still wore the robe to show that they were as good as the other guys. And then what's the deal here?
I just want to spend, if I can, a few minutes. You'll have to stay overtime and like it.
Well, I'm just going along. I've always wondered how everybody else had a chance to get dressed on such short notice.
That's second-hand skirts, obviously.
Yeah.
Second-hand skirts.
But, you know, it's like, come down to the party. Come on.
They must have been given the robes from the king, because obviously they wouldn't have any.
Well,
and you could say it's the one who didn't have a robe, it wasn't his fault, it was a fault of the servant who didn't give him one.
Fair point.
Thank you.
Now if they do him in.
All right. Well, maybe, but that's the sense. The sense there is, okay, I mean, I really want to hit hard this new invitation and to say, where is the gospel in this parable? It's this, right, that the honor of the king, right, in order, and again, the kind of, it puts the whole notion of snubbing, you know, on the one hand, yes, grace snubs our self-righteousness. But on the other hand, by doing so in this way, right, the king is also basically snubbing himself. Or again, if we want to use highfalutin language or anything, this new invitation and everything that's going on here, the Christ hymn in Philippians 2, or this is again talking about a theology of the cross. Right?
Isn't it the balance between grace and disgrace, really? I mean, he's disgracing himself in order to offer grace and bring grace.
But he's being forced to do that. If the initial invitation had been fulfilled, you wouldn't have had to do that.
Right, but I don't know if he's being forced, because you see there again, I think that's one reason Matthew might have given us that first response of the king. Those folks who snubbed him the first time, what am I going to do? I'm just going to kill him. Right, and if you will, the parable could have stopped there, and then the king would have maintained his honor, because now the word is out, you mess with this guy, you're going to get it. But no, he now goes on and does all this other stuff, which is, again, right, the reversal and surprising and troubling, and my goodness, I don't like this at all. Yes, please. Here and there, and then I will talk about the wedding garment so Bob can leave.
Snubbing himself, though, he's the king. He's really the kind of the source of all power and honor. Isn't it possible that he's just saying, maybe you're trying to snub me, but all sense of honor and status, I'm the king. Honor and status come from me. So you can have your own idea of what honor and status is. I just changed the game rules.
Okay, I'll use a contemporary example. We know that Prince William and Kate were married, and now they're coming over today. In fact, it's Canada Day. Oh, Canada. And they're in Ottawa. And Kate and William are going to be touring Canada. Unfortunately, they won't be staying at our house. Why not?
Because you're up here.
You're here.
Had they said we're coming to your house, we would have stayed home. Right? In other words, they're not going to stay with us, right? To invite us, because that'd be a real step down for royalty, or so they think, right? And so that understanding here again. The king, yes, he's the king, but it would be totally breaking all the rules of what it means to be a king to dishonor yourself and invite the wretched of the earth into your state dinner. Right? Again, that's a shocking move. Yes, please.
Well, the other thing about inviting the street people or ordinary people or what you have you, in place of the people who didn't want to come, you're pretty much ensuring yourself a pretty good party. They're going to be really excited because
they're
at the king's banquet. Cool.
Yes.
Never would have thought myself here.
Yeah, the folks are going to be excited, or supposedly excited. And that gets us then to say, okay, now what happens with this final wedding get, right? Why aren't you properly attired? And I think the sense here, what Matthew is trying to say, is that when we respond to the gracious call of God, we spruce up our conduct.
Right. Spruce up.
Our conduct. In other words, to put it in, again, very old-fashioned theological terms, good works follow from faith. In that sense of having received the call, having received that invitation to say, that notion there of even so, right, I'm a street person and all of that, and now all of a sudden the king invites me to the banquet. Well, I'm probably going to try to, wash my face and comb my hair. Because, that's right. I'm going to party, and I'm really excited, and I'm going to try to look as good as I can for the king and at that banquet, right? Because that would be just the spontaneous response to that kind of invitation. But this one guy didn't do that, and so the king says, out of here. Yes, please.
So he knew that he was being dishonorable.
The one who was cast out?
Yes.
Yes, I think so. Again, remember, the other thing here is, if you were here yesterday, we talked about this, the parable of the laborers in the vineyard, the great banquet, and Judas are the three places in Matthew's gospel where Jesus calls, or the word friend is used. So it's that kind of thing. At least in Matthew's gospel, if Jesus called you friend, watch out. Because the indication here is that somehow, right, you are laboring under an illusion. You think you're a friend, but really what you are doing is betraying. Your conduct is such that you are betraying the relationship, to use the Judas sense of that. right? And so what's happening here, this guy who is cast out is betraying the invitation, the gracious call, the relationship that is there. Again, it's another way of dishonoring grace and the work of the king. And again, that notion of being clothed, the wedding garment, and all that entails, right? Clothing, clothed in righteousness is a common metaphor. We are clothed, right? In our baptism, we are clothed in Christ. That notion of clothing, wearing the proper clothes, is a metaphor for faithful Christian living and conduct, a way of talking about love. Numerous places this shows up in the New Testament, again for time. Let me give you just two. The first one, Galatians 3, verse 27. Probably the one that would be familiar to most of us. If someone would look up Galatians 3, 27 and read that for us, and then Colossians 3, 9 to 10. And if someone would look that up, Colossians 3, 9 to 10. And whoever gets one of these, read it so we all can hear and hear that clothing metaphor. Yes, please.
This is Galatians 3, 27. For as many of you as have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ.
Right, and that put on, the literal sense of that is clothed, right? You've been dressed in Christ, and then what follows from that is our sense of equality, right? Once you're dressed that way, no Jew, Greek, slave, free, male, female, all of that. Colossians 3, 9 to 10.
Do not lie to one another, seeing that you have stripped off the old self with its practices and have clothed yourself with the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge according to the image of its creator.
Right. Catch that in terms of stripped off the old self, clothed with the new self. That's the imagery, I think, that's going on here about this guy, right? Isn't wearing the proper garment, didn't strip off, didn't spruce himself up for that banquet. And therefore, right, still falls outside. Yes, we need
help. Well, if these people who are at the banquet are the new worthy, they're only worthy by declaration of the king. And that's the garment that I would have thought the garment would have been offered as they arrived. Like, it's not a sense that you have to bring your own garment, but yeah. You know, you don't have one, okay, here we have one. But this one refuses to, like, put on Christ, put on grace, put on them.
He received it, but he didn't put it on.
Great. So it's kind of where you're saying, I don't need grace. I'm
standing
on my
own. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. The parable doesn't tell us that. I mean, it very well could be that, you know, we know in banquets and stuff, when you come there would be servants and whatnot who would watch your feet and all of that stuff. I mean, the king could be handing out garments as well. Again, quickly here, this is just Luther's interpretation of this parable, and interesting because we note he kind of changes his tune on this a little bit. This is Luther in a sermon in 1522. So this is, you know, here he's still the hot, irascible whippersnapper, justification by faith alone, pushes that hard. Here's what he says about this parable, this section. The wedding garment here is faith. Without faith, no one can remain at the wedding. On this text, all the church fathers were dreaming, like Jerome, Augustine, and others, since they related this text to love. Pitiable human beings did not see what Scripture everywhere requires, namely faith alone. If this faith is present, everything else follows from it that belongs to love.
Huh.
Do you think he's got a point of view?
Yeah.
Here he is, 1537. Right. A little more mellow. Melanchthon's had time to get to it. Right. Here's what he says again on this, quote unquote. Those who see the wedding garment as love can be tolerated. If only they... What, right? He's opened up. Can be tolerated. tolerate it if only they do not mean that the invited were justified thereby. Faith, which puts on the righteousness of Christ, right, there's our clothing metaphor, is the true wedding garment. It is active through love and does the works of love. So again, you see the gracious invitation from Luther said, bestows upon it, right? We're wearing our faith, but of course if you're wearing your faith, it means you're also spruced up with acts of love. And if you don't spruce yourself up that way, then right, in that sense, the invitation has rendered itself null and void. That's, I think, one way to take the garment imagery, and I think primarily because linking it to the clothing imagery is where we have to go with that. But we have to go. You've been resilient to be here. Thank you.